Now, for example, we released this Thermalytics breast cancer screening solution. Why would a doctor use this? To understand that, it's like, it's not easy. Like, you need to get into the shoes of the end user, ask all the questions, right? And also be open to understand that, you know, your product may not be able to, may not be solving the real problem. Maybe there is a slightly adjacent one you should be solving. So you have to be open enough to evolve your product to fit the gap that exists in the market today, right? The product market fit that we talk about.
Hello, everyone. And that is my guest, Dr. Geeta Manjunath. She's the CEO of Niramai. Niramai is a deep tech startup offering a radiation-free, non-invasive, non-touch breast cancer screening solution. So I spoke to her back in September 2017, and she's back on the show again to give an update on how they're doing. So in this episode, we'll talk about their core technology called Thermalytics, how they innovated during the pandemic. She talks about how they create AI and ML models. It's a bit of a deep dive, but she explains it very nicely. She talks about scaling issues and being part of the Google Launchpad and Philips accelerators. She talks about how they've shortened the B2C sales lifecycle from 6 months to 6 weeks. She talks about developing an AI-based computer aiding software for controlling the spread of river blindness with the help from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And finally, she takes a trip down memory lane and talks about being a member of the CEDAC team, which built the first commercial supercomputer from India. So please enjoy the show. Thank you. Hi, Dr. Geeta. Thank you for coming back on the show again.
It's a privilege, Neil. Glad to be back on your show.
Awesome stuff. I spoke to you in September 2017, a long time ago. What's been going on since I spoke to you?
Lots. I think September 2017 was long ago. Mm-hmm. And at the time, we just had a few working installations of our solution. You want me to recap what we do?
Yes, please. That'd be great.
If you recall, at Niramai, we have developed a new method of detecting breast cancer, using artificial intelligence over thermal imaging. And so here we just measure the temperature variations on the chest for the lady and use a smart software to analyze these 400,000 temperature points per person and generate a report automatically saying whether something is wrong, where is it likely to be wrong, and what's the probability that it requires an attention immediately. And so this is what we call as Thermalytics breast cancer screening solution. Mm-hmm. And it kind of makes it a non-invasive, radiation-free, safe, privacy-aware, automated, affordable, accessible solution for breast cancer screening. And last we spoke, Neil, we had a couple of installations, women were very happy with our test because it's completely no touch, no see, kind of a privacy aware solution. The last 3 years plus, we've done now about 35,000 screenings and installed in more than 70 different locations in India in 15 cities. And more coming along, and many, many women happy that they were able to find their early abnormalities and taking care of their health proactively.
Yeah, it's amazing because last time I spoke to you, I think you had three hospitals signed up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, diagnostic chains like Apollo Clinic, Health Spring, and HCG, all of these big names where they're chains of hospitals. So what happens is once you start discussing with a hospital or a customer who has multiple locations, right, enabled with diagnostic centers of different sizes, your go-to-market and scaling becomes very easy, right? Because they will, of course, do an evaluation for one center, but then, boom, you can actually sort of spread it to multiple cities and multiple locations easily. So that's the sort of approach we've taken, and it's really helpful. We've also been able to get into some of the government hospitals and also a lot of screenings outside the hospital as well. Portable and small device that you can put in a backpack and take it out. So got a lot of good feedback and good camps we've done in corporates, in offices, for example, or even villages, working with cancer societies, NGOs, to take the solution to places where, they've never done a breast screening before, right? Because of the lack of accessible, high-quality healthcare. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I remember you talking about some doctors that were skeptical. Yes. Are they still skeptical now?
No, we have multiple converted doctors, if you will. Of course, initially, the doctors will be a little skeptical because it's a new test. No, they've never read about it before. And so they always, evaluate before trying it out. Now, of course, we've partnered with these doctors to provide the solution for their evaluation, independent evaluation, in fact, so that they can test in a very, very grilling fashion, if you will, that every person who's coming in, we take our test, we give the result, they will not tell us the answer, they just go ahead and do mammography, ultrasound, biopsy, and then they compare the results at the end of the test, if you will, right? So we've done that and published in top journals like American Society of Clinical Oncology journals and so on. So that there is more clinical validation, independent clinical validation by reputed hospitals that we've been able to achieve. And so with that, we do have many, many doctors, saying that this is a good solution, let's use it, and many doctors using it as well now. We've crossed one big hurdle, I would say, at least in India.
Is this still a startup then? Have you left your mum's basement, as the old saying goes?
Yes, Niramai is still a startup. We have progressed in terms of revenue, but still not profitable, because many things, in general, healthcare startups take time to sort of get to that hockey stick aspect of it. We are just about 55 people now. It's a small company. Yes, it is a startup still, though it's a four-year-old startup. And we continue to evolve, go to different customers in India. Our aim is to sort of establish ourselves in India this year, and also try to sort of see how this can impact many other women outside India as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the Thermalytics. Is that a cloud-based solution?
Yeah, Thermalytics, absolutely. Thermalytics is our AI-enabled software solution, which is hosted on the, along with a hardware, which can actually capture the images of the breast. When I say images of the breast, it's actually measuring the temperature. There's no like a real image. So what we do is, when we go to a hospital, we give both the hardware and the Thermalytics software, which is a cloud-based solution. So together, when we go to them, we just say, okay, give us a room. We will set up the whole hardware software solution with a doctor who would certify the reports, evaluate and certify the reports for your patients, right? So that way, what happens is, when you go to a diagnostic center who, the diagnostic center may not have an expert radiologist on their in their pool of doctors, but still we have a panel of doctors who actually are able to review and certify our reports. So with that, any diagnostic center can start giving our reports almost within a day, right? They can just start, literally we speak to them today and tomorrow they can start providing the service to their end customers. So this is possible because we do the end-to-end solution, and also because our Thermalytics is a cloud-based software solution, where all we need to do is to provide a login for this particular new customer, and immediately, bingo, it's on, right? And also, multiple, because cloud enables this isolation of customers, right? What we call as multi-tenancy. Because of that, the data from one hospital is not mixed up or available to other hospital data, which is a very crucial piece, because privacy of data, especially patient data, is extremely critical, right? So we can maintain that because it's a cloud-hosted solution and so on. So that's sort of the one thing that... the scalability of the solution is enabled because it is cloud hosted. And also, whenever we have lots of people, like a camp that's going on, you can always add on additional compute on those days so that it's much faster. And because it's real-time screening, real-time report generation, if there's a lot of load, it can add additional compute. If there's not much load, it can just ease out by releasing some hardware and so on. So this cloud enablement really helps in the elasticity of compute that's needed.
You wrote the software yourself, is that right?
It's completely in-house developed. In fact, the software itself, the AI-based engine itself, is also patented because it's a completely in-house innovation. The patents, basically, we have 10 US granted patents, Canada patent, India, China, Singapore. So many of them are granted. Many more are even applied in UK and other European countries as well.
What were the main challenges of getting this to work?
Sure. Right. So the initial piece was really the first one and a half years was very, very critical to have the first customer to start using it, the customer being a reputed hospital per se, right? So I think that was the biggest challenge. And now what happens when you go to a hospital now, of course, they keep checking, is it regulatory approved? Yes, it is regulatory approved in India, and it has been used by 35,000 women. So that means it is something that women also love to do, get a test done. The next hurdle is if you want to go to neighboring countries, for example, then again, every country has its own regulatory clearance. So two things here. One is the policy or the regulatory clearance is one aspect. Another is the clinical clearance, if you will. Clinical clearance is literally, validating, like I mentioned before, validating in a very, very blinded fashion by a reputed doctor, and then publishing in an independent authorship, right? In top tier journals. So that, people who read this will also feel that there is clinical validation. I think getting the clinical validation done and then getting the regulatory clearances done has been a major, focus in our company in the last year or two. And I'm very, very glad to share with you that recently, just earlier this week, we got certified on an ISO 13485 company by a German notified body, which is amazing, where, everyone in the world can be comfortable that it's a company which is a health tech company. Yeah, we're still a startup, but yes, it's a company enough which follows very strict quality management processes with high quality goals and objectives, and having processes in a way that it will meet these objectives, continuously improve these processes to make it much, much better for the customer and the partners, right? So that is what it enables. We are also almost completed our CE marking, which enables us to go to Europe as well as several other Asian and South Asian countries. I've been expecting the certificate anytime now. So this has been the focus, because that was always a challenge, right? Because getting a regulatory stamp is very, very important, because that validates the quality of your product, right? And then the efficacy of the product. All of this is very, very important, Neil, because that is what will enable customers to adopt the solution with minimal questions and minimal evaluation. And that is what we learned was needed to get to the scale. Getting from 1 to 10 is one kind of challenges in getting the product right, ensuring that the product is liked by your customers, both the end users as well as the paying customer. It could be different, right? And then the next 10 to 100, if you will, right, is a different scale kind of a issue, scale kind of problem. One is how short can we make the sales cycle, right? We are talking to B2C, right? So that means we are talking to enterprise. First of all, the decision-making itself is slow there, right? In addition, if the first doctor that you meet in the hospital itself says, I have never heard about this before, and tell me how it works and does it really work, right? So starting there, these kinds of regulatory clearances and clinical acceptances really is bringing down the sales cycle from some 6 months plus, plus it was before, to maybe like less than 6 weeks, right? So that's the sort of thing. We, of course, want to compress more by having more and more. And so some of the things that happened because of COVID also gave us a lot of learning, which of course was a huge challenge posed to every startup, particularly healthcare startups, had both mixed feelings, I would say. Every hospital saw a decline in the number of people walking into a hospital, right? Because one, their people were very, very stressed, a lot of restrictions on the staff, many of their nursing staff and clinicians refused to come to a hospital, and so they had reduced resources, as well as, more importantly, fear from end users to get into a hospital, which may have, contamination aspect of it. So, and also we were, because of the lockdown and so on, hospitals were also saying, asking their patients not to come to the hospital for non-critical care, right? Not emergency, if there is no emergency, no need to come in, and so on and so forth. Yeah. And because of that, there was a reduced number of people who were walking into the hospital. That clearly hit our screening numbers quite a bit, of course we were troubled because, the number of, because we are revenue share based, the screening numbers affect our revenues, severely hit now because of that. So the innovate, and we be innovated in two ways, Anil. I'm happy to share that if that's of interest.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. We said, okay, ours is a radiation-free test, right? And so it doesn't have to be done in a hospital. We have proven that by doing outreach camps in villages and so on. How can we evolve now to make it available to everyone in a similar fashion? So we launched a completely new B2C service, which is a home screening service of breast health, which is the first ever time you hear a breast cancer screening or a breast health screening being done at home, because this is radiation free, because it is portable, and because we knew how to set it up in any place and within 10 to 15 minutes, we were able to do this. And I'm happy to share that, you know, there's a lot of women who are very happy to have people come over to their home in, you know, with all the COVID precautions that need to be taken with masks and, you know, gloves and all of that. And because our test is also non-contact, right? Social distance is maintained, and there's good adoption for our home screening service. In fact, in the last 3 to 4 months itself, we found three people who had found them to be positive for malignancy, and they were also confirmed later as well. So it has helped people who were stuck at home, not able to get their breast screening done, and also it has helped us address the revenue. The second thing was use the same technology for COVID. So as you know, we were using thermal imaging device. We are continuing to use the thermal imaging and the software, which can understand the thermal image or thermal video. So as a tech team, we said, can we help the COVID situation in some fashion? And then we have now launched a new product called Fever Test, which is an automated COVID screening solution for offices which are opening up after the lockdown, for hospitals, for public places like railway stations, schools, also colleges and bus stations, metro stations, all of that. What we do is use the same thermal camera, thermal sensor, which you would see in the airports today, possibly, put it in the entrances of buildings. As and when people go by, we do a face detection and, measure the temperature, check if they're wearing a mask or not, and social distance is maintained or not. All of this is automatically analyzed using a computer vision based software. It's a new software we developed using the expertise we already had in thermal imaging. And then, so it's now an automated screening solution for people who are walking around in a building. Or in fact, it's installed in 2 main radio stations in Bangalore, which is the Majestic and the Yeshwantpur railway station today. And so this is a new line of product we released, and that is also helping us.
You mentioned patents. Yes. So our listeners, they may have invented something. What are the sort of like, what's the process? What are the do's and don'ts when you're sort of evaluating whether to take out a patent or not?
Absolutely. I think for a deep tech startup, it's very important to cover the IP, protect the IP, intellectual property. And so what we do is every time there is a bingo idea that we think of, we say, okay, is there a patentability there, right? So we basically do a proper search, in, of course, Google, as well as several other sources where you would find these ideas to make sure that it's not been done before. The good thing is that because very few people have really played with thermal imaging and AI, many things that we think of are something that's not done before. It's like family of innovations, I would say, inventions. So that's what we did. So every time, just to give you an idea, and this was not there in 2017 when we spoke. So what we said was, here is a solution we kept in a hospital, and now we wanted to take it out, right? And so far in the first 1 year, me inclusive, right? All of our tech team and our own Niramai team members used to go and do the screening ourselves using our own solution.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not scalable. So we said, okay, can we train a health worker to do this? And we started training other people, low-skilled workers, to actually do the screening so that, it really can be sustainable in these areas as well as scalable, right? And when we started doing it, we found that they were making a lot of mistakes, to the extent that, they used to take left breast and call it right breast, and so on and so forth. A lot of confusion because it's a mirror image, right? When you see a camera and take an image and so on. So a lot of errors were happening, and they were taking it too close or too far away and all of that. So we said, okay, how can we help, right? Can the tool tell the lady, the lady who is the technician who's screening, that she's not doing the right correct thing. So we actually developed, 3-4 different machine learning models and software enabled features in our software, which can check whether the position of the person is correct. Is the person cooled enough? Is the person taking the right view? Is it right label or left side? All of these individually, different ideas here. And all of these became individual 4 to 5 patents just in the area of how do we ensure the person is doing the right kind of imaging? So this is where, like, you know, the mother, necessity is the mother of invention, as we say, right? So that's exactly what happened. When we wanted to give the tool to, in the hands of the health worker, we figured out that in order to reduce the skill needed to use the software has to be smarter, right? As and when the software becomes smarter, it has to be more, ideas into it, intelligent and so on. So obviously it's a scope for IP, intellectual property. So all of these were also finally filed. We generally, because it's India developed, nowadays we first file in India and immediately, if it's a good one, we actually file in the US and also certain countries where we think, Niramai solution has a great potential to market in future. So that's how we've done. And, of course, as and when we continue to improve the accuracy of the solution, right? We come up with some new ideas of doing it. For example, we figured out how to get vascular structure from a thermal image, that is blood vessel structure. And that's again a new idea. And so that again was covered and things like that. So how do we use thermal images for not just breast cancer, but other type of diseases? For example, breast health itself, is so important even for during pregnancy and motherhood, can we use it for that segment of women? It's called a mother care. So we came up with some ideas there. Then we got Bill Melinda Gates Foundation grant for using the same thermal imaging for detecting river blindness. So there again, we had to invent some new stuff as to how do we actually determine whether there are some worms under the skin and so on and so forth. So essentially, all of these are new ideas. It's kind of adjacent because it is building on the technology expertise that we have, but each one of them is sort of requires some new invention, and that resulted in patents. So now almost 16 to 18 patents have been filed, just in the last few years.
Awesome stuff. So when you're building an algorithm in the early days, right? And you don't have the data. How do you get the machine to sort of learn what to look for example, in the river blindness one?
Right. So it's a very good question. When there's not much data, how do you actually train it? So typically what happens when you have a very small data set, first is you have to figure out how do we actually augment the data, right? Figure out ways of, for example, the same person, same data, you take it in different sort of views. And then there is like pseudo augmentation, like scaling, rotation. Many of these methods are used to increase the data size in a little bit of an artificial sense so that, there's something that you can do with it. Having said that, the first few models are going to be pretty much hand-coded, right? Hand-coded features. As and when you increase the data size. For example, 4 years ago, when we were working on breast cancer screening, we were just like 500, 600 samples, right? So that was mostly hand-coded, features, reading a lot about the semantics of the disease itself, because not everything cannot be just purely statistics, right? Because medicine and human body in particular has a lot of phenomena happening inside, and that is expressed in the form of these thermal signatures, right? So we need to understand that phenomena and model that phenomena, understand the medical literature, and then, handcraft those features which are able to depict these patterns, right? Which is capturing these phenomena, I would say, right? So this is also found in literature, medical literature, and so on and so forth. In addition, of course, we have a lot of the statistical features. So all of these are handcrafted, and then you build models, But as and when additional data becomes available, now fast forward 3-4 years, now we have 150,000 images of people, which is pretty good for even running deep learning networks, right? So now we use deep nets for many of our solutions, such as what I mentioned before. Is the person in the right position? Is the position, is it left breast, right breast? We call it view labeling. All of these is just simply using deep learning, because that enables us to take care of a lot of generalization that is needed in the model. To take care of very, very non-specific details that may be there. So the models also evolve over time when you have more data. But if you have less data, it's very, very important to understand the domain semantics and handcraft the data. Because until you have that, until you have the handcrafted ML models, probably traditional ML models, you know, there are a couple of things that happen. One is you will now know, you know, what are the key features, semantic features that the model needs to use. And this is important. This is important to make your output interpretable, right? You know, we talk about interpretability of results. The same handcrafted features can be used for making your output, making the report that's generated by the tool interpretable by the doctor. Otherwise, the doctor says, yes, you're saying she's cancerous, but why the hell should I, believe the tool? How do you show? And where is it going wrong? You know, what's going wrong? Why do you say this is positive, right? All of that you can answer once you have a handcrafted semantically kind of featured machine learning model. Mm. Now, when you add statistics, you only enhance it, right? So that's what happens over time, I would say. As you add more data, you also have newer cases, different subcategories of cancers, for example, we had not seen in the first year. And then obviously, first time it ceases, it may not do well, right? It will miss it. Then you actually kind of analyze these false positives and false negatives. You have continuous, a thread of clinical validation and clinical checking that happens in parallel in different locations, different sites, so when this happens, when you find a false negative or a false, you can always evolve the model, by either innovating in the feature set or we obviously enhancing your training. And one thing that comes across here, Anil, is how do we release the new models, right? Unlike in other fields, in healthcare, we have to be very careful when we release or make the AI happen in production, right? You know, that is very rare, especially for such cases of critical decisions like cancer or no cancer. We cannot afford to do online learning. So what we do is to basically use the AI inside the developer house, if you will, right? So what happens is when we figure out that there are some false positive, false negatives, then we kind of rebuild the model, you know, fully do the testing on our regression test of like a lots of thousands of data that we have, labeled data, test it out, make sure that the result with the new training set is better than the previous one that is in production, and only then, you know, give a go ahead or a green signal for the release of the next model. Though this is not necessary from a technical perspective, because we are dealing with lives of people, we have to be very careful about your release model. What these are called as locked models. These are locked artificial models, artificial intelligence models, which are fully tested before they are released, right? And only locked models are released to the production. In production, it's not going to learn live, you know? So that's what right now we are looking at. And most AI models are in this model because it's much safer to the patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely very important. So is this like supervised or unsupervised learning then, the right way to go about it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So it's mostly supervised learning because, when you look at this whole solution, Neil, there are more than 10 machine learning models functioning inside, yeah. Right? When we actually look at the final report, there are about 3 to 4 scores, 4 scores today, and all of them are supervised because these 4 scores give the probability that the person is malignant or non-malignant. So it's a 2-class classification, right? But when you actually sort of move see within the software, to figure out whether it's a left breast or a right breast, it's not just enough that it is like 2-class. Typically, we take 5 views of the person, which is frontal, left, oblique, left, lateral, right, oblique, right, lateral. So it's 5 views. And so it's a 5-class classification. And so that again has to be supervised as such. However, when we start doing something nice, one of the things that we did and it's recently patented, so I'll be able to talk about it here. You know, when you use deep learning and you have these features coming out, the report will say, you know, the hotspot extent is, 0.0037 micrometer. I don't know. Like the doctor doesn't know what that means, right? Whether it's high, whether it's low, it's good or bad, doesn't have a clue. So what we did was it's called semantic interpretation of data or features, where we combined, converted those features into a scale, discretization, we call it, like, you know, 0 to 10 number. And we also said if a number is above 5, then it's kind of bad, right? You know, it's kind of indicative of a feature that is, you know, adding towards the malignancy probability. And if it is less than 5, it is not. So it's again, it's a patented algorithm where we use a combination of supervised and unsupervised learning to say that, you know, our group of features and which are values, if you will, you'll determine whether the person is, or the feature itself is, you know, contributing to the malignancy or not. So now when the doctor looks at our report, one is there are these scores which give the probability of malignancy, but double click on that, you actually have the features, you know, which are readable, understandable, interpretable by the doctor. And then these features also having these score ranges of 0 to 10 indicate whether this feature was wrong. And that's why the machine learning is saying that it is positive, right? It's kind of a cause-effect kind of a mode is something that we have created and using multiple machine learning models while doing this conversion from, you know, raw feature values to interpretable 0 to 10 kind of value. So like that, it's mostly supervised, but there are a bunch of unsupervised learning wherever you want to cluster some data, cluster some features, you know, unsupervised is used as well. So another thing that we have played with, I would say played with because it's still not in production, is also to kind of data augmentation using newer techniques of GANs. We call it generative adversarial networks. These are, you know, networks where two machine learning models will play against each other, right? You know, in some sense, and trying to sort of generate newer images, you know, artificial images of breast thermal images. You know, you would have seen, and the audience would have seen a lot of this faces, you know, being generated. You know, these are, you know, people who do not exist in the world, but when you look at them, you feel like it's a real photo of a person, right? These are generated like that. How can we generate breast images so that the models become stronger, you know, while playing with this generated? So we have also played with this GANs and other techniques, you know, in this. And finally, when we talk about deep learning networks and talking about methods that we're using, whenever there is a annotation that is involved, for example, when a person comes in, there's an image of the breast chest area that's taken from, let's say, the cheek to the stomach, right? You know, that whole area. And then here we need to sort of segment the breast area. It's called the region of interest marking. So that's an annotation of the image. So here we use something like a decoder or encoder kind of a network, like a UNET or a VNET structure. And so that is what is used. So input is an image and output is also an image. You know, it's supervised, but it's not supervised in a class label sense. It's supervised in an image annotation sense. And that's how sort of we do all of this annotation related machine learning models. Whereas in breast cancer, yes or no, it's a pure classification of two class classification. So it's very, you know, it's a solution with very interesting machine learning models and techniques that we've used. And of course, we have to continue to sort of, you know, look at literature, see newer techniques and experiment with it. So we actually hire a lot of interns. And again, the audience, if somebody is interested, they're welcome to join us in these exploratory activities where, you know, we continue to try out newer models, invent new methods to actually make this, you know, more and more perfect.
Awesome stuff. Yeah, you mentioned the team. We never talked about your co-founder. Talk about the co-founder.
Right. So Nidhi and I started Niramai in 2017. You know, she was my colleague at my previous organization. She was a product manager and she holds a management degree, you know, from IIM and from IISc. And I also have a management degree from Kellogg's. So it was fun. Initially, we were brainstorming quite a bit to define the product, do the first installation of the customer and so on and so forth. But you know how it is, like, you know, for a women entrepreneur, it's a lot of stretch, you know, to do, you know, 100% in work, 100% at home, and also sort of be fully sort of available in both sides and so on. So after about 2 years or so, she actually is no more with Niramai. So and 2019 onwards, I've been sort of running the show along with some very, very impressive, experienced leadership team that we have. And Yeah, sometimes it becomes very solo and pretty depressing. But of course, we have wonderful investors and board members who come in and sort of almost be like the founding team, you know, to take the solution forward. Yeah,
because you're the CEO and CTO. That's quite a difficult job, wearing two hats at the same time. Why not just find a CTO and then you can do the CEO?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Of course, we do already have very, very smart three people who are handling, one handling the engineering excellence, another handling the product excellence, another handling the data science excellence. So, you know, happy to sort of get someone up there, yeah.
Were you part of the Google Launchpad Accelerator as well?
Yeah, so talk about that. So we have received a lot of support from the ecosystem, I would say, national and international ecosystem. Yes, we were part of the Google Launchpad Accelerator program, the only four startups selected from India. And this was an accelerator program held in San Francisco, you know. So they, Google did a great job in the boot camp that we had in the initial starting and then the end of the 4-month period, where we got introduced to really top-notch entrepreneurs who have done it, like, you know, multiple startups, you know, successfully exited as well as launched and so on. So we had opportunity to meet each one of them, learn from them. We had the opportunity to meet none other than Eric Schmidt himself, who built Google, what it is earlier, from zero to sort of 10 type of thing. And then, of course, we met many, many prominent, reputed people who have accomplished this in startup world, the tech world, and so on and so forth. So that was amazing. And also meeting founders of similar thinking, right, across the world, right, around the world, and exchanging ideas, exchanging thoughts, and coming together and discussing a single problem, right? We see a lot of commonalities and differences both, right? You know, it's very, very interesting exercise we had there. We also were incubated, if you will, at Philips HealthWorks after that, which was also very, very, you know, energizing and educative, because we met all the we understood all of the nuances of medical field per se, right? You know, the regulatory aspect that I talked about earlier, and what does quality mean for healthcare versus any other software, for example, right? And how do we sell, you know, to hospitals? So a lot of things we learned at Philips as well. There were their first HealthWorks incubation program, accelerator program, as well as, you know, multiple national level. Recently, we were also announced as a winner of National Startup Award, mm-hmm. right, 2020 in healthcare category. And that was awesome because we got a lot of visibility in the national TV. Like, you know, we were on all of the channels in all languages and all that. It was like amazing. And subsequent to that, a lot of people writing to us about wanting to have a free, you know, home screening done and so on and so forth. So that was amazing. So in general, we have received a lot of support from the ecosystem, I would say. And I think this is a great time to launch a startup.
Definitely. During your time at Google Launchpad, then how did the product change then?
I think the product, yes, there has been some changes definitely from a scalability angle, right? You know, first we were looking at of course these models being all monolithic, and we knew that at some point in time we have to break into what's called as microservices, which is a new you know, not new anymore, but basically enablement of multiple web services working together, each of them having their own small functions, micro functions, if you will. And in a way that, you know, whenever there is more load, you can, you know, replicate new instances of the same function. And whenever it's not, you know, you can come down and so on and so forth, right? And you can actually push this microservice to any other, you know, compute versus, you know, this kind of elasticity we talked about in a compute sense needs to be first also embedded in the application sense, right? So this microservice enablement or containerization is another word that we use for this. It was something that we learned, of course we knew, but then when we actually mixed and learned with all the technologies of the launchpad, we got more confidence to try this out in real. So I'm happy to say that our production actually right now uses some of these microservices, which were initially very, very lab-centric, now really production-centric. I think this was a major technical change that happened. And also in the thinking, right, you know, when you meet many accomplished entrepreneurs, the kind of questions they ask, you know, make you think like, is this the right product market fit? You know, one of the questions I really loved is that we said, okay, hospitals are customers and we sell it to them. So, you know, one of the persons came and said, yeah, this is correct. They are your customers. They are the paying customer. But actually, maybe you should think of hospitals as distributors, you know. Said, like, what? Yeah, they're distributors where they're distributing your product to their consumers, right? You know, so it's a different outlook altogether. Of course, your exact business plan may not change, but the thinking about the business changes quite a bit. And you start sort of, you know, having the pricing models aligned with this thinking, right? You know, I think this kinds of things were very, very critical, and we learned a lot in this and what kind of pricing works, and also UI design, how important the, you know, the user interface, how do we measure that people are happy with the user interface you have. Though, only hospital workers or trained workers will use our user interface. Finally, what happens is that, in order to make less and less mistakes, and as I mentioned, that's a huge problem, and you actually give the tool to health workers to play around with, right? In order to ensure that there are less and less errors, you know, you have to make sure that your UI user interface is also more intuitive to the user. So I think there is a bunch of sessions on how do we make it more intuitive, the usage itself intuitive to the user.
Awesome stuff. All's going well. Last few questions then. I think on the other podcast, you mentioned that you're a member of the CDAP team, which built the first commercial supercomputer from India.
Yes.
And I never followed up on that, and I've been kicking myself since that 2017 interview. But when was this?
Yeah, so the CDAC was long ago. 91 is when I joined CDAC right after my master's. That was the time, that was my first job. I was very thrilled to be part of this gang who built the supercomputer, who wanted to build a supercomputer when we joined, it was not yet there. And so I was like a fresher, so I was put into this integration team, with like some really, really smart guys around. So where I had to understand every module of the supercomputer because it has to sort of integrate and work, right? So that was the most learning experience the first 2 years where, of course we have to integrate and test it out also. When you test, something breaks and you have to figure out where and what happened. So you have to actually know many modules fully, each of the modules in a black box sense and many modules in a white box sense. That is what happens inside as well. So that was a huge learning experience. This was when Sam Pitroji was sort of a big scientific name in India, who brought telecom revolution, is attributed to him. So he's the one who thought about having this this small R&D team to sort of try and build the supercomputer, right? So a bunch of us in Bangalore and a bunch of us in Pune, we said, okay, this Bangalore team builds the software for the supercomputer and then the Pune team builds the hardware, right? You know, that's how it was segregated as far as I remember. And we used to do a lot of back and forth, to make sure that there is enough synergy between the hardware and the software team. And we did release. And later after 2 years, I also went on to lead the compiler and tools team to build all of the developer tools for the software stack, as well as because my specialization at the time was compilers from IISc, Indian Institute of Science. And we also made a compiler is basically a tool which understands software programs, right? So we built a tool where people could write simple programs in a sequential program, as we call it. And the tool that we developed used to sort of, compose it and break it up to make it run on parallel computers. Supercomputers are basically these machines which use multiple compute nodes, computers internally. So a single program which runs on a single computer is taken and then split into, let's say, 1024 such computers, which are, which will be crunching the same operation, split way. So it's like 1,000 people working on a problem versus one person. So suddenly there is a scale, work which takes 100 days takes half a day and so on. So there's a huge performance benefit. And that's that splitting of a single sequential program to a parallel program is something that I was leading the parallel compiler tools development for about 6 years. I worked there and it was amazing. It was a startup of its own, matter, I would say, a lot of synergy, a lot of, people energized to build this one. And of course, I think sold to multiple countries as well. And it's still there. It's like a whole
still going. Okay. Not in a museum then. What did they actually do then, this commercial supercomputer?
Yeah, so now I think they use it for several other applications. At that time, it was like simple weather prediction, for example, right? You know, we just go to Google and then say, what's the weather today and what's it likely to be in 7 days? But we rarely understand how much of compute is happening in order to do this prediction in the back, right? So and then what's nice is these kinds of problems, the prediction of weather, for example, requires a whole lot of computation, but these computations can be done in parallel, right? You know, this is called SPMD, single program multiple data, because they are looking at multiple geographic points and sort of computing all of it together and so on and so forth. So these kinds of, data crunching, which can be done in parallel for what was being done, like, you know, also fluid dynamics, you know, so how does the temperature inside an oil pipe, look like when an oil is flowing, and if there is a crack, how does it look, and so on. So these were like different kind of applications. From a system side, we had to make sure that a computation which is taking, let's say, 6 months to run to give the answer would do it in like 6 hours or so. So how do we do this? How do we sort of, improve the performance was the main goal. Of course, now we have all the GPUs and all of that that's come in. Which are trying to do this same thing in a chip. You know, it's pretty interesting and to see how things have evolved in the last 20 years as well. But you want to make sure that you are able to do it on real existing computers, and then you can evolve the hardware to make it smaller and smaller, like more.
How big was the first commercial supercomputer then?
So it was a room full, the room being, let's say, a 20 by 20 feet, 20 feet by 20 feet kind of a room. We used at that time what's called transputers. So basically machines which have four legs or hands, so it's like, think of it like a grid, they're talking to only their neighbors, four neighbors, and then things have to move around within this whole mesh of computers, something like that. So that was a huge room full of compute power, if you will. Racks of computers sitting there, 1,024 of them.
1,024 computers?
Yes, yes. And then there has to be a single software that runs across all of them. And it makes sense, right? Of your simple, like the end user is still a simple program or something that runs like simple C or program. Fortran program, something like that. But then all of them have to be split and all of the 1,000+ compute has to be utilized fully effectively. So that's a challenge, and that's an interesting system programming challenge that I had the opportunity to work on.
Wow, sounds amazing story that. Let's talk about entrepreneurship. Do you have any new insights on entrepreneurship? I think you said get your hands dirty.
Right. Yeah, I guess I was talking about how to actually learn about, analytics, data science, and so on. So I honestly believe that we need to, try it out. Just reading books or, seeing videos are not sufficient. You really have to download data and try it out. Now, talking about entrepreneurship, I think over the last 4 years, I've learned a lot of things. And I would say it again, like basically, if it's required, basically, what I learned in the last 25 years of my, corporate innovation journey, right? I think I learned at least double of that in the last 4 years, if not more, right? So there is definitely a lot of tech part, which thankfully, my experience at Hewlett-Packard, Xerox, and and CDAC actually gave me, because I kind of work with really, really smart people and learn together with them. But then when you become an entrepreneur, yes, there are multiple things that come in. One is the definition of a product is not just an algorithm that you're doing inside your computer, right? You know, it's much, much more. When you talk about a product, the definition of a product, it's about, what is the end user using? Why is he or she using? Why is this important? And then why would the person use this instead of another one that's happening right now? Like, you know, for example, we released this Thermalytics breast cancer screening solution. Why would a doctor use this? To understand that, it's like, you know, it's not easy. Like, you need to get into the shoes of the end user, ask all the good questions, right? And also be open to understand that, you know, your product may not be able to, may not be solving the real problem. Maybe there is a slightly adjacent one you should be solving. So you have to be open enough to evolve your product to fit the gap that exists in the market today, right? The product market fit that we talk about, right? And in order to do that, right, you know, the kind of conversations you will have is so very different, right, from what you would do as a scientist talking to another, you know, colleague or some, or even a customer there, right? So that is one big piece of it. And I talk like some things that I talked about, right? When you actually say, okay, this has to be used in a hospital setting, or maybe even in villages, right? You know, so we said, okay, we'll keep it, we'll take it to villages and use it. And bingo, there was not much power available. The electricity was, you know, going off and on. So it had to be battery operated. You know, you have to make sure that it's working in the hands of, you know, low-skilled health workers. So your software has to be much smarter. And also, most importantly, what we realized was that as a product definition itself is that, you know, you may not have a doctor to review the report all the time. Most importantly, people who come in and, you know, they'll get screened, and you, if you go back and say, I'll review and give you the feedback or result in 1 week, you know, the customer is no more there in front of you. She will just go home. And many of these camps, right, you know, people used to come from far off villages to get the screening done for this health camp and so on. So you, people never knew how to go back to the same customer or same user who probably we said is, you know, has an issue with breast health, right? So all this required us to innovate on a real-time screening, right? You know, real-time screening, automated screening in the hands of health workers, it was a huge, huge learning, right? Which basically meant the product has to be so perfect that, you know, with very, very minimal human intervention, it's able to give a pretty accurate results, right? So that's a huge learning, right? You know, because as a computer scientist, you say, yeah, 95% accuracy should be fine, but no, it's not sufficient, right? And that kind of a learning of what accuracy means and what's the, you know, the risk of making a wrong decision and so on. So that's huge. And then talking to a hospital, right? You know, so again, when we talk about getting in the shoes of customer, there are multiple, you know, stakeholders we have to think about, right? You know, one person who is using it, the end user, it has to be privacy aware and so on and so forth. Then a person who is paying for it, right? The final person who pays for it could be the, let's say, the finance or purchase department of a hospital. But how many people have to say yes to it before, you know, the person, the purchase department releases a check, right? You know, so getting, like, you know, the understanding what are the concerns they would have about the solution before adopting, and then making sure that you fix any of those issues in your product and then actually convincing them along the way. So those are like multiple learnings, and learnings on the regulatory clearances, policies. You know, I think there's a lot of learning that as an entrepreneur we get. And finally, last but definitely not the least, is the funding situation itself, right? So when I was in corporate, you know, obviously I never bothered about money, as it used to land in my bank, right? And it was so easy. So of course, here it's not like that. You have a bunch of very, very smart people in your team, in your company. Obviously, they need to be paid every month, right? So how do we kind of source that? How do we talk to the investor? How do we convince them to invest in your idea? How do we, you know, ensure that they are comfortable when you are doing the execution, right? You know, when do you take them with you? All of this is a huge learning. But what I would say, Neil, is if I knew all of this, you know, you'll think double, triple time, you know, before jumping off. But honestly, I think everything will be sort of smooth and, you know, it's a matter of fact. You know, if you know where you're going and you have a vision of what you want to achieve at least, right? And you give your 100% to it, right? You know, then remaining things are more like you cross all the hurdles as they come by. But you keep your eyes straight on the goal and keep moving on.
Keep your eyes on the goal, keep moving on, awesome stuff. What do you think is the main quality an entrepreneur should have then?
I think, you know, passion and understanding of the vision, perseverance, you know, towards the goal, at the bigger solution to the problem itself, right? So that, and then being very open. I think it's very important, learning as we be open and learn as you go. And a little bit of, you know, huddling is very, very important, right? You know, that kind of personal relationship with people. So that is also pretty important. It's basically a thought leader, right? You know, you need, if you need to have people in your team, the team should, respect your vision, kind of follow you, your path, right? And of course, they have to be, we have to go together as a team, but still, you know, being a leader means should have the vision and go towards it with good conviction and perceive.
Do you think anyone can be a leader then?
Yeah, anyone can be a leader. You have a thought which is useful, solving a real problem. And anyone can be a leader.
Awesome stuff. Right, Dr. Manjunath, thanks for coming on the show. For people who want more information on Niramai, what must they do?
They can come to niramai.com, N-I-R-A-M-A-I.com. If you have a specific query, write to contact@niramai.com and we will get in touch with you.
What does the name actually mean?
Yeah, Niramai in Sanskrit means being healthy. Sarve santu niramayaha. Let everyone be healthy. That's what Niramai means, being healthy, being without diseases. It also has an expansion, non-invasive risk assessment through machine artificial intelligence.
Oh, clever. I see what you've done there. Nice one. That's very good, that. Okay, Dr. Manjunath, thank you for coming to the show. Much appreciated, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, Neil. It was a pleasure talking to you and to your audience. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to Dr. Geeta Manjunath for coming on the show today. And for more information, please go to niramai.com. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe to the Indian Startup Show wherever you listen to podcasts. And once again, thank you for supporting the podcast. Hey, if you'd like to come on the show, email me hello@neilpatel.co and let's connect on Twitter @IndianStartupSH or go to facebook.com/IndianShow. Thank you and goodbye.